Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. What do salmon and acorns have to do with race, identity, masculinity, and femininity? We'll ask my guest, Kari Marie Norgaard. She's a social scientist, researcher, and author of the book Salmon and Acorns Feed Our People, Colonialism, Nature, and Social Action. Welcome, Kari.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also joining the conversation is Ron Reed. He's a co-founder of the Karuk UC Berkeley Collaborative and a cultural biologist for the Karuk Tribe of California. Ron is also featured prominently in Kari's book. Welcome, Ron.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me as well.
Well, Kari, we have so many intersectional points to touch on here, but I want to start our conversation with two quotes from Chapter 3 of your book, Salmon and Acorns Feed Our People. You start the chapter with a quote from Dawana Robertson, and I quote, "Indigenous research is vital for challenging deeply embedded colonial assumptions and practices that have long constituted Native peoples as objects of research rather than as authorities on their own lived experiences," end quote. Then you write this, quote, "Most academic knowledge generated today advances settler colonial power, even when the authors might desire otherwise," end quote. What's your message, Kari?
Thank you. That's pretty pithy stuff to begin with, and I appreciate it. I want to start by saying, you know, those passages that you read are about thinking about, you know, who has the authority to tell the stories about our world, and especially within the academy. You know, I'm a professor of sociology at University of Oregon, and in the academy especially, Native peoples have not been the authority on their own experience. And the work that's represented in that book is work that came out of life-changing work for me with Ron Reed, which is why it's important, and I appreciate your being here, Ron. And that book and those passages in particular are written to try to change that way of doing things where non-Native people are the legitimate storytellers in the academic world and otherwise, and instead have center the perspective of Native peoples themselves. And as I noted, that's really been a lot of the colonialism that we've seen on the land, is the idea of who gets to tell the truth, who has access to the truth, whose words matter. And Ron, it's really important to me that you're here today. And I don't know if you want to speak to that passage or what you'd like to say, but I just want to really make sure it's clear that this book came about out of the practice of research that he and I did together, that was very much led by Ron's understanding of the world, and that book in particular was really my attempt to take that back into the academic world. So it is a very more theoretical written book.
Well, let me get to Ron then. But what you're telling me is that it would require a societal paradigm shift to recenter who gets to tell their own story.
Yeah.
Correct.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Kari, for your kind words, and thank you for having me today. But, you know, I think what it comes down to is forced assimilation. You know, I'm going to jump right into it. You asked a hard question right off the bat, so I got to come back with a response, and I believe that's pretty much forced assimilation. You know, in California in particular, we're in extreme northern California, so a lot of things happened to us that that really has had an impact on indigenous lifestyle. First of all, I'd like to just say that, you know, demonization of fire has created a feeling of helplessness, a feeling of not belonging in the society we live at today. Through this process, erasure occurred, colonialism was at its height, and, you know, eradication of our indigenous knowledge was the end result. I feel like that this opportunity presented itself because of the dam relicensing process. And this might have been the first time that the Cudahy tribe was able to voice our opinion on the goals and objectives of the health and wellness of this river. And I think we've done a really great job of putting the issues out there and addressing them in such a way that that is understood by the public. And I just want to go back to our original documentary with the salmon on the backs of buffalo. And I believe that title says it all. The dams were put in place for hydroelectricity, but eradicated our primary food source, salmon. And that's why we're here today.
Ron, Carrie writes about you and her working together. Here's a quote from the book. Quote, "In the summer of 2004, Ron Reed and I set out to assess impacts of the dams on the health of the culture and economy of the Karuk tribe. Our work built on the environmental justice tradition in which affected groups collaborate with academics to conduct community-based science," end quote. Talk about the work you and Carrie did together and your thoughts about the Klamath dams now being removed.
Yeah, obviously that was a very personal time for me. And it's basically, we're basically decolonizing the nature of academia, because to me, history has never been portrayed in the right element, meaning that the Cudahy people were never taught about Cudahy lifestyle, indigenous lifestyle of the Klamath River, of the tribes surrounding us. We spent a lot of our time learning about the Sioux, the Iroquois, et cetera, and things that happened in America. But that adds to the sense of helplessness. That adds to the disclaimer that we don't know who we are. And if it wasn't for our ceremonies, if it wasn't for our creation stories, and if it wasn't for the persistence of cultural identity, we would not be available today. And what this process has done has allowed us to bring out the finer aspects of impact to the Cudahy people, the health impacts, the social impacts. All these things have been devastating on the indigenous lifestyle of the Cudahy people and other tribes in the basin.
My guests are Kari Marie Norgaard, author of the book Salmon and Acorns Feed Our People, and Ron Reed, co-founder of the Karuk UC Berkeley Collaborative and a cultural biologist for the Karuk Tribe of California. And Ron is featured prominently in Kari's book. Kari, you quote Ron in your book in the concluding chapter, which is titled in the form of a question, "Climate Change as a Strategic Opportunity." Here's the quote from Ron. Quote, "We are trying to get back to an intact world. Climate change can be a vehicle for that because of the awareness it brings to so many about limitations in the current management process. We believe there is genuine interest in Karuk perspectives about how to care for the land. We offer these explanations in the hope that this is true," end quote. Kari, do you believe that our dominant settler colonial society really cares about the environmental perspectives of the Karuk tribe?
I'm really happy you started with that quote, because, you know, when Ron shared that with me, I mean, I remember as you read it, just exactly where I was sitting when he shared those words, where you were sitting, Ron, up in the fisheries building. I think we are now at a time when the world is in crisis in many different directions. And one of the things that can happen, as Ron alluded, in that crisis is people do start to see the world differently. And I believe that that is happening. And, you know, we also, in the sense of that crisis, there's a huge amount of, you know, fear. Things are getting harder for all of us in different kinds of ways. And, but yes, I believe I've seen it in my students that I teach. I've seen it in the work happening in the Klamath Basin and the way that people are coming together. And yes, I think we are absolutely at a turning point where, as a society, many, many people are beginning to rethink our relationships with the natural world and understand our history in a different way that really acknowledges the humanity of Indigenous peoples as well as the humanity of non-Indigenous peoples.
Okay, well, I want to back up a little bit and get some historical context on both your lives. So, Kari, let's start with you. Where'd you grow up, and how did you find your path into the field of social and environmental science?
Thank you. Yeah, I grew up in California. I grew up in the Bay Area. I, grew up surrounded by sort of a mixed working and middle class background, surrounded by people who, you know, in the 70s, who were concerned about the world, the direction of the world. You know, it was a time of a lot of social change, as we're in now. And I grew up with a sense that, you know, grew up, my best friend's father was a scientist who was working in the nuclear arms race. So I grew up with a sense of urgency, both around what was happening in the world and what could happen at any moment. And I also grew up with a sense of responsibility and a sense of, I would say, empowerment that I could be a part of trying to engage in the world. And I did an undergraduate in biology at Humboldt State. And as I was in that degree, I became increasingly aware that it was really the social side of things that was needing more attention. You know, I had worked on multiple species that were in crisis and so forth. And so I ended up switching from my doctorate into sociology and social sciences. And, you know, at the time Ron and I were working together, I was working on a very different project and really got pulled into this work with you, Ron, and it absolutely changed the direction of my career. I think I had heard of environmental justice. I was interested in environmental justice, but I had not done work in this way that we started to do when we did that effects of the health effects of denied access to traditional foods on the health of the Kutuk people that was became part of the periphery licensing, that work that was, you know, what really set us off and was so pivotal for my understanding of the world.
Well, it's a good segue to Ron. Ron, it's your turn. Where'd your journey begin and what led you to where you are now? And how'd you meet Kari along the way?
Well, I can answer that real simply. Being born as a Kutuk tribal member, I was born into a Kutuk traditional family that practiced ceremonies, that practiced indigenous science, indigenous knowledge. We gathered food and used food out of the garden. My earliest memories were of those ceremonies, participating at the World Renewal Ceremony, the deerskin dance, the white deerskin dance, and also my earliest memories is of gathering traditional foods, multiple objectives, out there hunting acorns, mushrooms, and my uncles coming by and killing a deer at the same place. So those are the type of lifestyle that is embedded not only through my genetics, but through my early memories. Fishing down Ishpishi Falls is another early memory of catching or clubbing and packing fish for the dip net fishermen and providing at a very early age the concept of being a provider, being a protector was instilled at a very young age. And those are the things that kind of held me together after I stepped away from the ceremonies for social reasons, as another story. But basically, I was away from the ceremonies for 20 years and actually was in a social condition that I needed spiritual guidance. I went back and became the medicine man and now the ceremonial leader of the same place that my grandpa held, you know, in his lifetime. So those things right there kind of gives me a sense of responsibility, an inherent responsibility. And, you know, while doing that, when I made that medicine, I was able to kind of come up and find a job with Department of Natural Resources of the Kutuk Tribe with a spawning survey from Iron Gate Dam down to Happy Camp. And that opened my eyes. I did that for 10 to 15 years as part of my fisheries program manager appointment. So all of those things have really touched me in a way that by the time I met Kari Norgaard, I was full of it. I was full of both worlds, the indigenous world and the modern world.
Well, we're going to have to leave it right there for a moment. We need to take a brief break. My guests are Kari Marie Norgaard, author of the book Salmon and Acorns Feed Our People, Colonialism, Nature, and Social Action, and Ron Reed, co-founder of the Karuk UC Berkeley Collaborative. And he's also featured prominently in the book. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guests are Kari Marie Norgaard, author of the book Salmon and Acorns Feed Our People, Colonialism, Nature, and Social Action, and Ron Reed, co-founder of the Karuk UC Berkeley Collaborative. Ron is featured prominently in Kari's book. You can join the conversation via email at jx@jeffnet.org. Kari, your book explores the intersections between race, the environment, and the importance of human identity. So let's begin with race, as you did in the book. Chapter 1 is titled Mutual Constructions of Race and Nature on the Klamath. And you write this, quote, "Connections between race and colonialism are particularly important to flag because discussions of race and racism that do not incorporate colonialism extend the discourse of indigenous erasure that itself is a central mechanism of colonialism," end quote. So it sounds to me that the term colonialism could be a euphemism for the ideology of racial hierarchy and white supremacy, which is a common threat to all non-white populations. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Oh, thank you so much for, you know, all of this work. I have to say, you know, this is a hard task. I'm really in this book, I'm writing to other academic theorists with this, and I'm trying to, within my discipline of sociology, there has been really important theorizing around race as a social structure, you know, that was designed to move resources away from certain people and towards other people. And we think of white supremacy as, you know, all of the cultural practices and institutional economic systems which do that, which make an easier path for those of us that are determined to be white and a harder path for those who are determined to be other, and quote, other. And within my discipline, there has been, and in general in the world, less understanding that in the United States, we are also a settler colonial society. And colonialism is its own structure. It intersects with, you know, white supremacy or racism, but it's also, I would say, about more than that. And when we started this show, you highlighted the question of who gets to be a knowledge holder, who gets to tell the truth of their perspective.
Yes.
And, you know, the academic term for this has to do with the idea of epistemology. What system of knowledge do we accept to be true? And part of colonialism that's related to, but I would say beyond racism, has been, for example, the denial that indigenous peoples have their own science, have their own deeply rooted knowledge, have their own deeply rooted ways of experiencing the world from a spiritual perspective. And all of that is above and beyond racism per se.
If I understand you correctly, is colonialism then a power structure that determines whose voice is valued?
Absolutely. That's well put. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Ron, Kari writes that ecological systems prosper when humans and nature work together. And another one of your memorable quotes is early on in the book, and I'll quote it. "You can give me all the acorns in the world. You can give me all the fish in the world. You can get me everything for me to be an Indian, but it will not be the same unless I'm out processing, going out and harvesting, gathering myself." I think that really needs to be put out in mainstream society, that it's not just a matter of what you eat. It's about the intricate values that are involved in harvesting these resources, how we manage for these resources, and when, end quote. So, Ron, Kari refers to the Karuk as fix the world people. By comparison, are we in mainstream America a coddled and spoiled society?
Oh,
I would just say, you know, thank you so much for bringing this, you know, topic to the forefront. You know, basically, the Kudyuk people have lived, you know, on this planet for a very long time. And the indigenous knowledge that is portrayed is now being utilized. You know, well, let me back up a step. Indigenous knowledge was used for resource extraction. And basically, we'd use that to go out. They would come up and, you know, we're some of the best miners. We're some of the best loggers. And now we're some of the best firefighters. We've been using our indigenous knowledge to fortify this colonialism management process. So what the change right now is happening, and it's so important, is that indigenous knowledge has now found a grounding point. Now that fire suppression has been such an issue in all of America, now it is indigenous knowledge that has come to the forefront. It's not only indigenous knowledge, but it's indigenous science, as Kari alluded to earlier. And that is handed off by way of ceremonies, by way of creation stories. And those are the things that are necessary for Kudyuk ideology to maintain itself and to provide leadership in natural resource management. And to your question, it is against tribal law to harvest if you do not do positive management. In other words, you have to go out, and in my case particular, put fire on the landscape for our resources to be able to prove that we are providing positive impacts to the resources, to our non-human relations, so that we have that right to harvest. And that right to harvest is followed very strictly by way of our ceremonies and creation stories. So when that is erased out of our thought process, that's when the social impacts occur quite frequently.
Well, it sounds like the voice of the Kudyuk are being valued today in the management of the land. My guess are Kari Marie Norgaard, author of the book Salmon and Acorns Feed Our People, and Ron Reed, co-founder of the Kudyuk UC Berkeley Collaborative and a cultural biologist for the Kudyuk Tribe of California. Kari, in Chapter 4, you raised the question of what happens if there are no more salmon and acorns? How does that affect masculinity and femininity among the Kudyuk people? So how is gender identity tied to salmon and acorns?
Thank you so much. I think, you know, Ron alluded to that when you asked us to each sort of tell the story of how we got to where we are now. And, you know, he spoke about, as a very young person, learning responsibilities and learning about, you know, being down at the falls and fishing and all of these ways that he, you know, learned that he had a responsibility. And I hope I'm saying this appropriately, Ron. And so a lot of the practices that, you know, people have shared with me that are important, and in the passages that are there in the book, it's connected to identity, as a gender identity as well, because these are practices that are done, you know, by men or by women. And so as there's the possibility, because there's fish in the river or acorns to harvest, there's a possibility of engaging in these practices, one comes to understand femininity or masculinity. And again, that chapter was written in particular, you know, within my discipline of sociology, there really isn't an acknowledgement that how we think of gender, how we experience gender, is at all connected to the natural world. And so that chapter was written to try to give specific a different perspective with specific examples. There's a lot of quotes from people in their own words about what those mean in terms of masculinity or femininity.
Ron, I want to ask you about the state of California official apology. The governor apologized, I think it was back in 2019, officially for generations of harm that it orchestrated upon the indigenous peoples since the California became a state in 1850. And now there's a Truth and Healing Council that's scheduled to produce a report next year to the state. What would you like to see in that report? And what does truth and healing mean to you?
Well, you know, truth and healing means to me is I'm no artist, but I need to paint a quick little picture. Fire on one side of the spectrum, and fish on the other, with humans in between. It's our inherent responsibility to put fire on the landscape so we can have the right for these resources, and we follow the, less, for lack of words, the mandate of our ceremonies, to be able to follow those, to be able to manage for non-human relations, so we fix the world for all of our non-human relations, for as far as ourselves, as well as ourselves. And I think that what, I don't know what to say to your question. What I can say is that we need to stop the cultural appropriations. The people, I think academia is guilty of plagiarizing indigenous knowledge. I feel like the academia comes in, gets the information, build up their resume, go back home and create their, and start their career and live their lifestyle. Meanwhile, the people who give that information are left wondering what the next step is. And so in my process with Dr. Kari Norgaard and UC Berkeley and Cal Poly, other academic institutions, is basically allowing people to understand what we need as an indigenous society.
Well, you talk about relations with non-humans. Speak more about that.
Well, you know, I think that colonial management is basically single species management, reactionary management. The indigenous perspective is proactive, enhance, preserve, and maintain. That's what we do. And all the laws are set up for resource extraction. And the Cutup people have lived as a true environmental justice tribe. We have no reservation. We have no federally recognized fishery, hunting, or gathering. So we're left in a shattered existence. So therefore, we're using our indigenous knowledge to bring ourselves, our tribal members, our society out of the depths of disparity and to flourish. And that will be done in the future because we're doing it right now and things are happening at a very fast pace right now.
Well, Kari, I was reading your book in the aftermath of this election, in which the powers that were victorious across the federal government have views that are contrary to the Karuk perspectives of society that you write about and Ron's talking about. So what are your thoughts about the colonial mindset and its impact on society in the foreseeable future?
I think that we're at a time where there's so many different things happening, so many different agendas. You know, certainly, you know, you mentioned the recent election. I think everybody is sort of waiting to see what's going to happen as we watch, you know, the cabinet picks and the different things. I think it's, you know, we're at a very unknown time, so wouldn't feel like I could speak to what the future holds in that sense. But I do think we are at a time where something has been unleashed in terms of recognition of indigenous peoples in this case. And I think that, on the ground, those energies are going to continue to build momentum and to mobilize. And when we see the Klamath Dam removal, you know, this has been a profound event. It's a profound event ecologically already. You know, there are hundreds of salmon spawning, you know, in Oregon on the Klamath, well, 60 miles upstream of where the lowest dam was. There's, hundreds of salmon spawning right now. That's an enormous ecological event, but it also, the Klamath Dam removal has been a really profound social and cultural event. It's something that happened very much with indigenous leadership, very much influenced by indigenous sciences. And I think it represents, for all of the generations of young people, Ron's children, my son, as well as many, many other young people who've grown up with watching this, it represents a really profound awareness of what's possible. And so, I think that there's a lot of very powerful, positive things happening for healing in the world right now, and those will continue.
Well, it sounds like we're moving in the right direction, albeit at a very incremental pace. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. Thank you, Kari, for writing this important book. And thank you, Ron, for all the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much as well.
Thanks for having us.